looking on in our Parsha, I have the Sefer Panimim, Volume 30, edited by Rabbi Sheinbaum of the school in Cleveland, and they put it out every year. And he writes on the Pasuk, Re'ei limadeti eschem chukim mishpatim kasher tzivani Hashem aleikecha. Moshe says, see, take note, I've taught you decrees and ordinances as the Kadosh Baruch Hu, my God, commanded me. Chazal say, from this pasuk, Moshe Rabbeinu is telling Klal Yisroel to keep, right, the way of teaching the law to the people. In other words, whatever the style was, just as the way he did his missions, which was gratis, he never charged to teach Torah. Therefore, whenever a Jew teaches Torah to another Jew, he must do so for no compensation. And since the author does run a school, he says, okay, that cannot mean that the thousands of rabbeim, moros, Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbanim, etc., have to work for nothing. Right? You're going to tell me that what they do, he says, is not, quote, some type of profession? And he says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu set a rule in this, in our world, that we pay for services. So you cannot teach for learning Torah with anyone, but for something you're going to be compensated. He says, in our world, the salary paid often indicates the significance that society places on the task being done. If anyone who taught Torah never got a penny, how much degradation for that task would arise? And so he says, in the Yalkut Me'am Loyes, Harav Yaakov Kuli, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, gives the following example concerning Torah. And he says, an individual was very close to the ruler of a very small country. The ruler was a very brilliant and very benevolent human being. He really had no designs on aggrandizement. He was happy to be able to rule his small kingdom benevolently and didn't need anything further than that. Whatever he had in the kingdom was sufficient. And he had a very close friend who came to visit him. He gave his close friend a personal tour of the country and the palace. Then the two of them had a suda together, and they truly enjoyed one another's company, discoursing, talking, whatever they did. And when it was time for the guests to leave, the king gave his friend a sword. And he says, we've got to understand what that meant. In those days, a sword was part of the royal regalities, the royal people's method of dress. This sword was the finest pure gold. It was laid in with diamonds and other precious jewels. And no one in their right mind could ever really appraise this because it was just so valuable. And it was noticeable clearly that this was the king's sword, or at least one of them. And it was clearly recognizable this was the symbol of great friendship. The gentleman went home, and he says, all of the king's ministers looked at him marching out with the sword, and one of them became envious. He wanted this too. And he went to an artisan, someone, the world-class sword maker, I guess, and he had a facsimile made. He, for whatever reason, his gaiva required him to have the same sword. Weeks later, this minister decided he's going to take a trip. He wants to observe some of the other areas in the kingdom. And it seems that they had different, let's call them stakes. And each state had an entry fee based on what you were bringing in, similar to when we try to bring stuff from abroad into the country. And he said, do I have anything? I've got the world's greatest king sword. And they said, oh, if that's coming in to our property, here's the duty you've got to pay on it. And he became irate. He said, how can you charge me anything? I want to know, he says, I know that the king's friend came by this way in the past. What duty did you charge him? And they said, nothing. And he said, if that's the case, what's going on? Explain to me the consistency. And they said, okay, the sword that gentleman has is the king's sword. We know that it's got all the precious materials possible, and it's part and parcel of the king's royal uniform. We cannot value it. It is so valuable that we have no concept how to value it. And whatever we would say, we may run the risk of insulting the king. Therefore, it becomes tax exempt, duty exempt. Your sword is clearly made by an artisan, a commoner. If we want to value it, we'll take our best stab and charge you. And Rabbi Steinman says, people who have toiled, who are Isaac in the Torah, who have dedicated themselves, their families, to a life of Torah, right? Lilmoy Lulame, both learning and teaching, telling others, to them, the value of the Torah is immeasurable. There's no price. This is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's armor. And they understand that when you have such a magnificent gift from the Creator, you've got to teach it and give it to others. There's no value we can put on this. He says, therefore, Chazal tell us, no human being is ever paid for teaching Torah. Educators are paid for time. For giving their time when they could be doing other things, that's all they're compensated for. He says, they recognize the privilege of sharing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's knowledge and to be Klei Kodesh, to work in those fields, you've got to have something much more important to you than pure financial compensation. He then turns to the pasuk in our parsha, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Yaakov's sons, on his deathbed, said, Shema Yisrael, listen Yisrael, meaning Avram, our father Yaakov, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. Hashem is our God, and as we say in the Yud Gimel Midos, Hashem is one, whatever that means. One that encompasses all and everything. The Torah, or Chayim, gives us the halacha that we place hand over our eyes. And he says, why? Why do we do this? And he quotes the preface to a sefer called Kol Aryeh that says, two of the Rabbeinu Shloim's names are contrary to one another. Elohim is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who shows the midah, the attribute of din, strict judgment. Yud, the Hashem, right? Yud Kei Vav Kei, on the other hand, is HaKadosh Baruch Hu Rachamim, right? Mercy. And to anybody who thinks about it, on first thought, strict din, judgment and compassion don't seem to align side by side. And so, what are we doing? We're making a statement that is at best ambiguous. And he says, what we're really underscoring is that Hashem mercy and Elokeinu din are one and the same. To us, HaKadosh Baruch Hu seems at times to be a merciful God, and at times we see, unfortunately, what we perceive to be judgment. We have to acknowledge and try to understand that it all emanates from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And not only that, above and beyond it, even the din is encompassed in mercy. Now that's got a very difficult concept, and I think we always say that in front of a Kadosh Baruch Hu, kulay tov, everything is good, even though we can't understand how certain things are for the best of people. We have to confirm that every but thing that a Kadosh Baruch Hu is tov, even when it appears not to be. As Yaakov Avinu was going to go to Mitzrayim, he had a sense of trepidation. HaKadosh Baruch Hu appeared, and he says, I will go with you to Mitzrayim, I will bring you up, and Yosef will put his hand on your eyes, which we know happened when he was Nifter. This is the secret of Kriya Shema. The Kol Aryeh says, Kriya Shema expresses the Achdus, the unity of Hashem, and that we came that his mercy and judgment. And he says, this is a concept that many, many people frequently find too difficult to accept. When we're in a serious situation and there's a frightful experience, such as October 7th. We know it's din. And maybe he says that's why we cover our eyes. We can't look at it because we can't perceive the good. He says, nonetheless, our model is Yosef HaTzadik, who experienced one travail after another, right? The incident with Potiphar's wife being thrown in jail, right? Being kept there longer when the butler didn't remember him. At the end, HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes him out of the jail immediately, and he has a perspective how it all fits together for good. And that's what he tells his brothers when they finally learn it's Yosef, that whatever happened, HaKadosh Baruch Hu planned for good. He says, every human being in Klal Yisrael has a Shema Yisrael story, where things that seemed adverse somehow turned, in retrospect, to be beneficial. He says, we're talking that we live in the Chevlei Moshiach, in the area that's the birth pangs of Moshiach. We are living in a time that witnessed the greatest cruelty and pain Klal Yisrael will ever experience. He says, I am writing this while COVID's going on, and I am, as all my community is, in, right? We're inside. We're isolated. Why? We ask ourselves over and over, Ad Masai, how long will this go on? How long will the birth pangs of Mashiach continue? He says, I'm going to quote a story told over by Harav Yisroel Shertkever, Zecher Tzadik, to a delegation of Hasidim from Germany. They turned to him for some type of hope and reassurance as the Nazis began the reign of terror. And he said, I'm teaching. There were once two powerful kings who fought and conquered the whole world. Each had half. They would have continued fighting, but each one was more afraid of losing than winning. And so, one day, one king had a son and one a daughter. And they said, we've got the perfect answer. Let's make a shidduch, and the grandchild will inherit the entire world. Great idea. Unfortunately, it didn't happen because the couple were infertile. None of the doctors in anywhere could do anything. He said, finally, a doctor of brilliant proportions was found, and he said, I do have a solution, but it's life-threatening. If it works, it works. If it doesn't, they die. And understanding that the child was what was needed, the young couple said, we're prepared to sacrifice our lives. The princess conceived, and during the pregnancy, there were a number of issues, and the doctor was called. He succeeded each time in saving the fetus. Once the princess entered the ninth month, She was in excruciating pain. She couldn't bear it. And she said to the doctor, "Please, I need you to do something." And he said, she said, "I can't take the pain any longer." And this time the doctor said, "I'm sorry. This I cannot do. This pain I cannot alleviate. These are different pains. These are real things. These are the pains of childbirth. The only," he says, "cure to the pain will be the birth of a child." Said, "You've got to suffer these pains in order to bring the child to life." The Rebbe said to the Hasidim, "Do you understand? We are seeing the birth pangs of Mashiach. They will subside when Mashiach arrives. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will protect those who survive." Now, I'm sure we all feel that that's a difficult way to try to understand what happened. Shema Yisrael connects Jews. Secular Jews also know Shema Yisroel is the clarion call of Klal Yisroel. He says that in one of the Shomer HaTzair secular kibbutzim, one of the girls rejected the lifestyle and became a balas shuva. She became from. She became engaged to a ben Torah, and they decided to have the wedding in the kibbutz. During the wedding, one of the senior officials of the kibbutz, a secular Jew, asked one of the kibbutznik, who basically had been like a second father to the bride, he said, "How did you raise such a, quote, flawed, shameless girl who would humiliate you by attaching herself to this old, decrepit, foreign way of life?" The man said, "It began years ago when she was 8 years old. When she went to sleep," and I guess he was on duty, this gentleman, when they took care of the kindergarten. I guess sometimes they don't sleep in their homes. I guess like a dormitory. He said she would hear some words coming out of her mouth. And this happened every night. Finally, after hearing this for a period of time, we asked, "What are you doing?" And she said, "Oh." She said, "One of my close friends here in the kibbutz discovered an old book that her grandmother had. And it said, whoever will say Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad will be protected." The friend convinced herself to do it, and she actually got, he says, 60 girls doing it. And you want to know who the girl was who found the safer? It's none other than this bride. He said this girl learned it, accepted it, turned to others and said, "I guess this is a koineya, this is the red bindle or whatever. Say it, try to translate it, and you'll be protected." He summarized it. He says we have to embrace the unity of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's attributes, mercy and judgment, trusting that every experience, whether so difficult or so wonderful, can contribute to the notion of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's toif, greater good. When we cover our eyes, this is our way of showing we believe, right? And we're covering the eyes to find strength, that we can look at adversity as a challenge and look forward to better days, to simcha and geula. Okay.